This is Micha Sifri here from Personal Democracy Media, and we are here for our ongoing series of Personal Democracy Plus conference calls with movers, shakers, thinkers, doers, innovators at the place where technology and politics collide. And today we're going to be joined by two excellent friends of Personal Democracy, Deanna Zant, a media technologist and longtime troublemaker in the sphere, and Heather Holdridge, the digital director for Planned Parenthood. And what we're going to be talking about today with Heather and Deanna is this growing engagement of issues related to women's health and online activism colliding with each other. There's clearly been in the last few years a really gigantic internet wave of new participation across all kinds of issues, and so we shouldn't be surprised to see that same kind of wave of mass participation hitting the arena of women's health. And I think, as we all know, it is most recently crested in this kind of amazing four-day explosion of participation around the decision of the Komen Foundation to withdraw its support of Planned Parenthood, and then this really very widespread response led partly by the organization and also partly by activists like Deanna, free agents who feel viscerally this issue as something that matters to them. So we're going to really be looking at this as a great case study, both of how a big national organization like Planned Parenthood, with years and years of history, has adapted and is working in this new web space, and also how this kind of rising wave of popular participation online is playing out. In particular, as led by activists working on women's health issues. So without any further ado, I thought I would start really by asking Heather, tell us a bit, about your role at Planned Parenthood and a bit of, just some of the background, the history of the organization in terms of working with new media, and then bring us closer to the present where obviously this is an absolutely vital piece of the organization's infrastructure.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me, Micha. I'm thrilled to be here with you and participating in this. And, of course, it's like to have my fellow upstater, Deanna, with me on this, although I don't get the, troublemaking title so easily. But Planned Parenthood, and I'm relatively new to the organization, but the organization has been online and in engaging with supporters in this space for almost 10 years, if you look at the beginning of what we call PPOL, or Planned Parenthood Online Program. And that started with the insistence in a structured and meaningful way, as opposed to just having, what we all had back in the late 90s, which was essentially brochureware, right? So there was sort of a placeholder or a storefront or whatever you want to call it on the internet. But Planned Parenthood has had a sort of thoughtful structure and strategy for the better part of 10 years. And that includes not just the Federation, so PlannedParenthood.org and PPSA, whom I work for, but also at the affiliate level, because we have 82 affiliates nationwide who represent our and work for our health centers and serve our patient base. So we serve about 3 million patients annually, and our supporter base has now grown to over 6 million. And to talk a little bit about the trajectory of that, I'll just go back and say that I think Planned Parenthood's history is very similar to a lot of other nonprofits, larger nonprofits, which is to say that there was a web space that over time we've figured out how to make more interactive and engaging as the user experience has changed and become more interactive. That Planned Parenthood has had a strong email presence. And I would say that email presence has historically been the anchor and the main way in which the organization has communicated with our supporters over the years, mm-hmm. whether it be in an advocacy context or to educate them about women's health issues as they arose in the public arena. In the past 5 years, well, going on six actually, in the past 5 or 6 years with Cecile Richards as our president, she has become the voice of our organization online, or she has been, I should say, the voice of our organization online. And we have moved into the social spaces, into Facebook, into Twitter, into YouTube over the course of the years. But I would say that until last year, Planned Parenthood wasn't engaging in an active strategy so much as making sure they were in these channels where people were, right? Mm-hmm. We knew people were on Facebook, we knew people were on Twitter, and we were trying to engage with folks. But the sort of existential huge fight that the organization was engaged in last, it was actually this time last year, we're coming up mm-hmm. on a year on this, the fight over the defunding of the organization caused us to rethink and fundamentally change how we approach the online space. And so where that we, of course, used the power and the strength of our supporters to help win that fight, among many other organizations who were also backing us on that. It also opened the organization's eyes to the power of social media in terms of the ability of our supporters and the interest and passion of our supporters in speaking out on our behalf and doing it in their own voice. Mm-hmm. And I know we'll talk about this in greater depth as we move through this conversation today. And Deanna's work on Komen is a perfect example of this, that we represent our organization and what our strategic needs are and our voice, but we have a tremendous body and breadth of support of people who want to talk about their support of us and on our issues in their own voice. And we're learning, it's an ongoing day-to-day process, but we're learning how to harness that. So my work here in the past several months has been to start to get my arms around what our supporter base looks like and to think about how we best reflect the community back in ways that help us achieve our advocacy goals and our political goals as those exist. And so that, for me, has been primarily in the social space. And I've also been working very heavily on a project called Women Are Watching, which is essentially our brand for all of our political and electoral work this year. And we've launched a separate website and program around that I'm happy to talk more about later.
Women Are Watching. So I'm glad you bring us back a year to the fight over the Pence Amendment and the effort to cut off the funding for that Planned Parenthood gets from the federal government because of the effect it had on in terms of galvanizing, mm-hmm. This sort of latent layer of grassroots support. And so one question I just have for you before we turn to Deanna is how much mm-hmm. Of your work, apart from these, dealing with, what we're going to get into is, which is, what's the toolkit and strategy around mm-hmm. a hot media moment like what happened with Komen, but on a day-to-day basis, mm-hmm. If you're talking about a support base now that's really grown dramatically to something like 6 million people, what does that mean on a daily basis? What do you have to do in terms of listening and interacting with folks? How much of it is being mm-hmm. in a listening mode? How much of it is stirring the pot, kind of pumping mm-hmm. out information? How do you prioritize?
That's a great question. And as I'm sure many people on the call know who do this work themselves, we have someone who's dedicated full time. Actually, if you expand it beyond advocacy, my focus is on advocacy and political, but we have actually a digital health content team, and that's actually one of the changes that we've made internally, which is to recognize that there is a there's an opportunity and there's a need for us to speak with multiple voices depending on our different audiences. And so there's a digital health team that includes someone whose job literally all day long is to be listening for people who have questions about sexual health, reproductive health in an educational context. And then I have someone on my team whose job is to be listening and paying attention to what's happening in the social space. And to answer your question directly, Mika, around how do you prioritize that, as everybody knows, this is a very real-time and fast-paced world that we currently exist in. And what we try to do is ensure that early in the day that we are able to sort of put out our own marker in terms of whatever our particular communications message or strategy or priority for the day might be. But as I alluded to earlier, we also recognize the power and, frankly, the necessity of reflecting our community back so that if for people who do follow our Twitter feed, which is PPACT, P-P-A-C-T, if you do follow our Twitter feed, you'll see that multiple times a day, we're retweeting or modify tweeting what some of our supporters say, because we want them to know that we're paying attention to them and that their voice matters in this broader work that we're doing.
And then at the same time, so just expand one more on that point about the day. So you really think like a media organization also in the idea that every day you've got to be either proactively introducing something into the stream or being ready to react, that, there really is a kind of 24/7 quality to, in terms of managing your presence online that you cannot stop and ever relax.
Yeah, you know what? Unfortunately, I think that's the world that we live in. And one thing I will say that has changed since my arrival, and staff whom I work with might not love me for this, but and I frankly don't know, maybe other people have a better sense of this, we post consistently on social over the weekends. To be clear, the volume isn't the same because there's not as much happening. I mean, Congress isn't at work on the weekends. Other people are sort of taking it slower. But the news doesn't stop. And the opportunities to engage on the issues that matter to us and that matter to our supporters don't stop. So we post at least once a day to all of our major social media channels because people are still online. And what I have found, even though it loosely tracks, what are the most popular times for people who engage and whatnot on social media, is that people are commenting, liking, sharing, retweeting our stuff on the weekends if what we're putting in front of them has value to them.
Do you have metrics that you're trying to reach in terms of growing the base or deepening the level of engagement? I mean, again, apart from the sort of rapid response, deal with crises kind of mode, are you also working on general growth targets? I mean, obviously you've probably exceeded them. It doesn't hurt to be in big fights. Clearly, they can sometimes make you stronger if they don't kill you. But are there also sort of an ongoing series of goals for in terms of expansion?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer to that is yes. The longer answer is I don't think we've quantified it yet, because when you quantify something like that, you have to then take it out to the future and say, well, what is the qualitative piece to that? And what is the value of, let's just say we had, a million Facebook fans. Well, how do we utilize that in ways that actually helps us achieve our goals? And so while we need to get there because we want benchmarks by which we measure ourselves, I think we're trying to tread carefully so that we're doing it in a way that's not just a number that we're hitting.
Okay.
I'm so relieved to hear you say that, Heather.
So, Deanna, I want to pull you into the conversation now. I mean, you've got years of experience working on these kinds of issues, though, I think here, and you've done it for organizations directly as well as a kind of free agent. In this particular case, we wanted you on the call because of your jumping into the middle of this controversy with Komen with the Planned Parenthood Save Me Tumblr site. Mm-hmm. And so tell us a little bit about, you know, why you did that and what was, you know, I mean, for argument's sake, and just to be devil's advocate for a second, you know, I could say, well, why didn't you just trust that Planned Parenthood would take care of that kind of messaging?
Yeah.
What was it, you know, what was it that made you do that? What do you think the value of it was?
It started out, actually, I was in a conversation thread on Facebook discussing with other sort of nonprofit tech folk and other activists what our response as individuals to this fiasco around Komen was going to be, because we all felt activated by it. We all felt emotionally invested in things like breast cancer and women's health in general, and all of us felt like there had to be some sort of big response, not as a group, but just people were kind of tossing out different ideas, and a lot of the ideas were around fundraising. Well, let's take money away from Komen. Let's give money. Let's raise money for Planned Parenthood.
Right. And a lot was raised, right? A lot
was
raised.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jillions of dollars were raised. It was amazing. which is great and which is fantastic. And that's actually, you know, that's a really, really necessary component of any kind of push, you know, hit them in the wallet kind of either direction kind of campaign. So that's obviously really necessary. But what I kept coming to the conversation with is what about the people, and specifically women, who don't have money to contribute or not contribute? And those would be the women who had, you know, the biggest impact of losing services from Planned Parenthood are low-income women who need these breast cancer screenings and who need the other myriad of services that Planned Parenthood could provide. And I said, well, how do they get to contribute? How do they get to participate in hearing what happens, you know, to them? Mm-hmm. And so for me, you know, I always come back to this big thing, and I know that this is my shtick, but I have this whole thing about, you know, stories matter before you get to any kind of, you know, A-B testing of your email campaign or your petition on change.org or your whatever it is, whatever tool you're using, you have to start with stories. This is where change always starts. And I said, well, we need these women sharing their stories, and how let's do something. And I actually kind of did it a little bit irritated before I was heading out to a meeting. I'm like, let's just create a Tumblr here, you know, and I created Planned Parenthood Save Me, and I posted the link. And then I went to the meeting. I thought, well, geez, that's actually maybe a good idea. So I sent it out to a few people, and I specifically in the beginning was asking for women whose cancer had been detected by a Planned Parenthood clinic. It just went out way further than that. Just so many women started submitting these stories of Planned Parenthood was the only place that I could go after I was assaulted where the people understood me. Planned Parenthood taught me about sex. I had no idea even what I was doing when I went there for birth control. You know, like just a myriad of stories about how Planned Parenthood had changed their lives.
Let me back up a step, though. How did you, I mean, some of this is sort of a needle in the haystack effect, right, of reaching those people. So how did it?
Well, this is like the dirty secret of advocacy work, is that it's not just posting it once to Twitter and hoping for the best. It's choosing it, going through my address book, and I chose about 20 women who either work on women's health issues or are heavy hitter feminists or, you know, people that I felt would have influence on the topic. And I think what Heather just was saying about why I said that was so great, that she said that about, you know, having a million Facebook followers isn't really a great qualitative metric to have, because, you know, I could have tried to send it to somebody at a major media outlet or somebody who, you know, has a bajillion followers and hopes for the best. But what I chose instead were people that I felt would be influential in a topic so that it would spread faster through networks. Because that's the key, is finding ways that it can spread quickly through networks and not just hoping that one, you know, that Ashton Kutcher tweets it out and that everybody's happy.
Didn't it work for Coney?
Yeah, you know what? But Coney is a totally crazy, you know, off the charts kind of example, and it's, you know, obviously crazy and fraught with a million other problems.
And they had early networks too. I mean, actually,
yes.
The closer we look, it turns out that it wasn't the celebrity push at first, but it was also the existence of already developed local networks.
And so what, that's actually the interesting thing when you're talking about metrics and benchmarks, since we're all, you know, big nerds and we love data and numbers. I went into the analytics 3 days after the site had launched. We had collected around 300 stories. And I wanted to see kind of where things were coming from and how this all happened, because it launched on Wednesday morning. Thursday night, Rachel Maddow was reading it on her show.
Wow.
And my head sort of popped off and rolled down the hall. My, you know, and I had to rewatch it again later. Like, really, did that just happen? In any case, so I went on Saturday and looked at the metrics and analytics. And in the 3 days that I had data for, we got 28,000 unique visits to the site, which is a nice number.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing is that more than half of them came before any major media mention of the site, and all of the traffic came from Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. So it was about people sharing, and specifically in this case, women sharing stories with one another, and how compelling and powerful that can be when stories get spread kind of ad hoc and peer-to-peer. And that was like what just kind of, about the whole situation, what just totally blew me away. And what I loved about it was like, well, it didn't matter. I didn't get hardly any traffic when the New York Times mentioned it. Jennifer Preston mentioned it in one of her pieces, and it was on Maddow, and it was on all of these things. And sure, we got little bumps, but it didn't make the site explode. It was women sharing their stories with one another that made the site explode.
Did Planned Parenthood, I'm curious, Heather, if you would comment on then how you guys inside Planned Parenthood viewed something like this. Was this a problem because it was kind of like a wild card? Oh, what if, you know, something gets posted there that's off message? You know, how did you relate to it?
Sure. That's a great question. And Deanna's Tumblr was an example of something that, you know, Deanna and I have known each other for a long time, but I didn't, Morgan, who does our social media, saw it before I knew about it. And so, which speaks to her point that this kind of spread. And that was an example of something that we, not only did we love it, we promoted it on our Facebook page and on Twitter, because there were parameters that within which we could engage and within which we wanted to talk about this situation that we were in with respect to Komen. But we didn't want, nor do we want, to be critical of them, because we because this was a sort of, they were a victim of larger forces in the decision that was made. And so I'll put it this way, we were selective about the ancillary, whether it was a Pinterest site or a Facebook page or tweets. There were innumerable examples of people who were engaging on this issue in their own voice and in their own way, and we were selective and tried to be strategic about amplifying those voices that we felt told the story in a way that we wanted to make sure more people saw. And so seeing Planned Parenthood Save Me to put that personal story and that personal imprint on who we are and what we do and how we exist and engage in communities was an important one. And I think it was more powerful because it came from the outside as opposed to something that we organized.
I completely agree with that. I mean, that I don't think that Planned Parenthood could have said, hey, we just started a Tumblr. Can you guys all come and say how awesome we are, you know?
Yeah, especially not with that Planned Parenthood Save Me, right? I mean, that's, you know, that's a little bit like, hey, you're great and everything, but, you know, you don't need to toot your own horn in that way. And we weren't interested in that, and we're not.
Right.
But, you know, Heather, I know you haven't been there that long, but one of the reasons why for me, and I think for a lot of people listening, this is such an interesting case is, again, we're talking about a fairly, you know, big traditional, you know, legacy organization is the term we like to use, that for a very long time, you know, the general approach to message management is, you know, you've got to control how you're being talked about as best you can. Whereas here, you're clearly describing a mentality inside the organization of, you know, that we can't get in the way of our supporters. If anything, we want to let these flowers bloom and then just maybe pour a little extra, you know, sunlight and fertilizer on the ones that are particularly good for helping you, right? So was there some kind of shift inside Planned Parenthood that had to happen to get people comfortable with taking this approach, or is it just self-evident?
Well, self-evident, I certainly wouldn't go that far. What I would say is the Pence fight last spring, where it certainly wasn't the same, and I mean that's a whole other conversation, right? But because that was a sort of traditional political fight in a lot of ways. But I think that the Pence fight, and again, was not personally here at the time, but the overwhelming support that happened there, I mean, this happened over 2 months as opposed to, this is not a four-day campaign. But the Pence fight, the organization got 850,000 signatures on the petition. This is to Congress, right? I mean, you know, not that sexy, right? But got 850,000 petition signatures saying, don't defund Planned Parenthood. It's important to me. And so it was that. We actually launched this Raise Your Hand campaign, which was a little more personal. Again, we launched, but it was people raising their hands and saying, I'm one in five women, which is the statistic about how many women over the course of a lifetime will visit Planned Parenthood as a patient, one in five women. So, you know, we had people literally raise their hands, take a picture and say, raise your hand. And so I think that was the first time where we were genuinely experimenting with things outside of what I would call traditional advocacy vehicles. And understanding and seeing the power of that, I think the evolutionary piece of it was that we understand more broadly that the traditional, you mentioned toolkits, right? Toolkit that is available to nonprofits goes beyond the tools that, say, a governmental relations team might see as valuable, which is, I want to be able to say we've sent 10,000 letters to person X or Y, and we're going to bring them up to the Hill and do that. There's value in that. I think what the shift is that, and this is, I think, particularly true of Planned Parenthood, though not exclusive, of course, is that we have a supporter base because we are a healthcare provider. There's a certain connection that we have with some of our supporters and activists where they want to engage with us in a more personal and intimate way, and there's a power to that that we're still trying to figure out how to best harness, for lack of a better term, so that their needs continue to be served, which is we have healthcare available to women in this country writ large. And so that's on the micro level. On the macro level, it's making sure that Congress is continuing to support and fund this great need in this country.
I just want to add to something that, that Heather said, that one thing that I think Planned Parenthood has done very successfully, well, two things actually that I want to comment on, about changing organizational culture, and it goes back to Allison Fine and Beth Cantor's book, The Network Nonprofit, and how important the executive leadership in a nonprofit is committed to social media. How much that will change an organizational culture. I think from what I understand of Planned Parenthood's culture, Cecile Richards' participation, and full disclosure, she blurbed my book. She's awesome. You know, I totally love her, you know, whatever. But I think that makes a huge difference in how an organization's priorities end up becoming, because I've worked with organizations that where the executive leadership isn't invested, doesn't care, and just hopes for the best, and they have incredibly unsuccessful social media deployments. And the other thing is about that emotional connection that Heather was mentioning, that so many women have an emotional connection to Planned Parenthood, whether it's through the health care that they receive or through the advocacy work that Planned Parenthood does. And one thing they've done very successfully in the last couple of years is turn that emotional connection into a relationship. And the kinds of emails that you get from Planned Parenthood and the kinds of things that they put out on social media and the conversations that they're having, they are taking the connection and turning it into a relationship. And that's what social media is so much about when it comes to advocacy.
Great point. Let's pause for a second. Now we're at the halfway point here, and I want to invite people listening, if someone wants to chime in with a question or a comment, this is your first opportunity. Just hit *6 on your phone, and then I'll be able to pull you into the call. We'll just take a pause to see if anybody wants to do that. Sometimes people are bashful. Sometimes people want to jump in. And I will keep the conversation going in the meantime. Heather, does Planned Parenthood connect its members up locally? To what degree is this a one-to-many relationship? I grant that relationships are being formed, and certainly, there are active commenters on Facebook pages. You probably have a sense of who some of your super activists are, but I'm just wondering, with a list that big, and in particular with obviously Congress is a fulcrum for you, of you can't avoid it, you've got to either play defense or play offense with Congress. So to what degree does Planned Parenthood think about kind of congressional district by congressional district connecting up its supporters?
That's actually a really good question, and frankly, that's part of my mission. So, of course, Planned Parenthood has been around a long time, 95-year-old organization, and we have existing and strong political department, field department, et cetera. So, and we have the affiliate structure. So we're a unique animal in this way, and one of my charges, if you will, in this role that I'm in, is to work across all of our program areas and all of our divisions to be able to integrate digital and online into everything that we do. And that doesn't mean that, that you need to have a Twitter strategy for every single thing that we do, or we have a Facebook strategy for every single thing that we do, but that we are thinking about how to integrate that piece into the work that we do. And so with respect to, thinking about, okay, well, how do we help facilitate these sort of localized connections in the context of the broader universe that we're seeing, I would say it's aspirational. And it is part of what we're looking to do with the Women Are Watching program, in making the connections between online and offline. And actually that goes two ways, right? So it's online to offline back to online.
Say a bit more about Women Are Watching. That's a new thing I hadn't heard much about.
Sure. Well, Women Are Watching is our political program, as I mentioned earlier, and we launched on Election Day 2011, which, we were all, a lot of the Planned Parenthood were very heavily engaged in the Mississippi Personhood Ballot Initiative on that day as well, which we were very thankful to be victorious on. But so the Women Are Watching campaign is our wrapper. It's a way for us to talk about women's health as a political issue. And honestly, when we were doing the planning for this, it was aspirational that women's health would be an issue in the campaign. I feel like we can sort of check that box. And not to say that Women Are Watching was a critical instrument in that, but with a lot of the broader fights that we've had, and including most recently this campaign and all the hullabaloo around birth control access, this is something that people are paying attention to. So it is our attempt to highlight candidates who are with us, our champions, and who are not with us, our chumps.
Right. This is Planned Parenthood Action Fund now, right?
Yes,
we're talking
this is our
about
Action Fund. That's right.
C4.
This is our C4 work. And so we're focusing on both candidates. We're focusing on states, and many people who do follow women's health issues know that there has been a lot of activity at the state level.
God help us.
I mean, seriously, right? But there's been a lot of activity at the state level across the board, and that's been a tidal wave, and not necessarily in a good way. And also educate people about the issues that are at stake. But I would say the new thing, and not new as in Planned Parenthood's never done it, but it has been for the first time in a couple years, is we've actually started a blog on Women Are Watching, which, you know, this
how innovative.
Is not, I know, right? I mean, so this is not
a weblog. That's crazy.
Yes. What is new for us is, because Planned Parenthood has a lot of layers and a lot of voices and perspectives that that we're bringing to every conversation. I'm talking about internally. I'm not talking about externally. And
sure.
So the challenge for us in this is to be relevant and interesting. When you start talking about blogs, the expectation is that you're in the zeitgeist of what's happening, and we certainly have a perspective that we think is valuable in this broader conversation. And the challenge for us is to figure out how to engage in that in a timely and meaningful and relevant way. So that's been our sort of signature piece to it. But the other piece to it that I find exciting is our potential for being able to focus on and raise up and elevate some of the state level fights that are happening. And there are obviously many people who have been doing incredible work around that who are not Planned Parenthood. But we've been trying to help and engage in that because we are engaged very heavily in those fights, you know, in state capitals around the country.
Right. But what this portal, I mean, I'm actually on the site now, womenarewatching.org, and I can see all those features, but we've still got a situation here where these are kind of, this is a way for an individual activist to sort of affiliate and get timely information, obviously, and maybe plug in, you know, knowledge-wise to what's happening at different state-level kinds of battles. But it's not an activist platform in the way that you can think of a Ning site or I'm thinking of the right wing site Freedom Connect, or MyBarackObama.com, you know, as another example. All of these are places where, you know, supporters not only get to sort of give you information, but they get to create their own groups, their own activities. So it has not yet moved to that place, but is that a place, you know, with a 6 million supporter base, you're clearly at the point where, you know, even if it was just only 1 or 2%, that's still a lot of people who might well want to be knitted together. I'm curious, Deanna, you know, if you would, you know, sort of add your perspective here on, you know, the larger picture of women's health activism online, the degree to which you're seeing, how big a wave do you see
it's
now?
Freaking huge. It's huge.
Freaking huge. Could you quantify
freaking
that?
Huge. Yeah. Well, it's been really exciting. I mean, I've been involved in feminist activism for, do I want to say how long? Maybe 20 years. And I haven't seen this amount of energy from people who I wouldn't consider kind of hardcore activists in a really long time. And I think that, you know, when you're talking about building platforms and all this stuff, like, sure, those tools are great, but I'm much more excited about the kind of fluid and ad hoc that's happening, and that to participate in these kinds of events doesn't mean that you get commissioned a "this is what a feminist looks like" t-shirt and then, you know, that's it, now you're a feminist. You know, the identity is much more fluid now, that you can kind of roll in and roll out where the moment strikes you. And I think that women have that kind of, having that kind of freedom to participate when they can is actually enabling a lot of people to participate more actively than they had in the past, where it's not as much of a emotional commitment perhaps or time commitment. And I think also that having that kind of freedom to, you know, going back to the peer-to-peer and the storytelling stuff, you know, we saw when we were talking about defunding Planned Parenthood last year and as part of H.R. 3, which came into the House and it was this time last year, wasn't it? It was February-ish.
Mm-hmm.
As part of that movement to defund Planned Parenthood, there was also language in H.R. 3 that would have federally redefined rape to not include incest or not the inability to give consent because of intoxication or incapacitation. All of these things would have been actually removed from the federal definition of what rape was. Mm. And so a couple of activists, Sadie Doyle and Amanda Marcotte, started a Twitter campaign, a hashtag campaign, mm-hmm. called Dear John. And they had people tweeting stories of why this is a really bad thing, often women's own stories of their own sexual assaults, with the Dear John hashtag directed at John Boehner.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately that language... Oh, so I set up... a little analytics thing to track the tweets. And in the account that I had, you get like something like 5,000 free tweets or something. I was like, oh, that should be plenty. And we used that in a day and a half, you know, over 5,000 in a day and a half. And ultimately that language was removed from the bill. And I don't think it was necessarily just that a bunch of people got on Twitter, but it inspires other actions to start happening, and it inspires the change.org petition, or it inspires Move On to get involved, or it inspires that more kind of organized platformy thing to happen, and they work in conjunction with each other. So I don't know that it's always important to talk about, well, what's the next new platform?
I guess I'm not suggesting, I mean, you know, this is the where I was hoping we'd get to in the call, which is this understanding of the different moving pieces of the social media toolkit, and to what degree, you know, it's sort of like an advantage to have all this fluidity, right? So, you know, it's incredibly quick and easy to do Tumblr, you know, a testimonial site like the one you did, or, you know, try to spread a Twitter hashtag. Obviously, you know, something like what I'm describing, which is more of a ongoing hub, you know, like a community hub sort of site, is a much more ambitious and in many ways hard to sustain model. I think it's interesting, if you look at Freedom Connector, like leave aside the ideology of the place, it was launched as an open networking platform at CPAC about a year ago, and in 1 year it's grown to about 175,000 active participants and about, 8,000 different groups and events listed on, through the tool. And so if you're a member of, the Tea Party or one of those associated movements, this has become a hub for, that set of identities and activists to reinforce each other for better or for good, right? Or for better or for worse. And at the moment, it feels like the women's health space, I mean, that Planned Parenthood is kind of like the big, the big mama here in terms of the amount of people it's got in its list, certainly, and activists affiliating through things like Women Are Watching. And yet I'm still sort of asking, would something more, enabled people to carry this sense of connection and relationship even further, would that be useful? And Deanna, what I'm hearing from you is that the fluidity, the freedom to come in and out, that you don't want to ask people for too heavy a commitment because they might not be willing to give it, and that it has to be more, we have to maintain this kind of nimble stance instead. Is that fair?
Yeah, I do think that's accurate because I also feel like the women who get activated by these things who want to take the next step, and become a committed activist in this particular work, through that entree, whatever they have, whether it was through Komen or whether it was through what was going on last year, and ongoing locally in the States, have lots of opportunities. There are lots of traditional organizations that they can participate in. And I don't know that it's necessary to have a full-on kind of platform. And I mean, one, because I'm always thinking about money, how mm-hmm. can we spend that money better? Are there better ways to spend that money? Cause that's a lot of money to build a platform like that, And is that the most useful thing that we can do with ourselves? I just don't know that it is.
Heather, what you know, you've got a little bit of money to work with. You also got a big institution to, you know, help support infrastructure wise. But you did say that, you know, sort of aspirationally, the idea of knitting together local activists more is something that you'd like to do. Did I hear you correctly on that?
Yeah, I think the question becomes, and this is where I get boring and sort of infrastructure nerdy, is the question becomes, how do we do that given who we are and how we're structured and as a federation? And so, you know, I think we need to think very carefully about how we do that, because our affiliates also have direct relationships with some of these folks. And so this is a wild, you know, sort of brave new world frontier, whatever you want to call it, where we have worked out the kinks over time in terms of what our relationship is to our affiliates in a web site context, what our relationship to our affiliates is in a Facebook, Twitter context. But in the context in which we're discussing this, that's a separate conversation, and I think it's a really complicated conversation. So we have to be careful about how we think about it and how we seek to engage and connect with activists in that localized way.
Right. And in a funny way, the internet is not necessarily your friend there, because it's almost too loose, and in some ways confusing. I'm going to pause again just to – we've got about 10 minutes left on the call. I want to make sure if anybody listening wants to pop in now with a question, here's your best opportunity. Hit star 6, and I'll get you into the queue. Always happy to have questions and comments from our very smart listeners.
Don't be shy.
Oh, we've got one here. Okay, go ahead. Just tell us your name and ask your question.
Hey, it's Megan Hall, and I have a question that it's a little geeky, but I mean, I guess this whole call kind of is. I'm wondering how you guys are planning on tying all of this sort of fantastic energy, where this much broader audience of women has kind of realized that their voice isn't in the room in either at all or in any kind of real way, in a decision-making way. To the efforts, and I'm kind of specifically asking about C3 things happening this year, for voter registration and updating people's registration. And a couple of reasons I wanted to ask is because this process tends to involve paper and the laws are different in states, I'm wondering kind of what your strategy is in terms of then what you're doing online kind of from a national perspective, how you're working with affiliates and how you're integrating that with your offline communication, because I think we all know that, you know, redundant messaging tends to be the most effective, especially when with an activity, voter registration, that usually involves like several steps and a stamp and things like that.
That's a great question. Heather?
Sure. Well, you know, you know, you did really nerd out on me. So, I mean, I think the answer to the question – I think you've out-nerded me. I think the answer to the question is – well, as I mentioned earlier, we have a field team, and they sort of oversee our work to register voters in concert with the affiliates in the various areas where we're running those – where we're running those drives. So, you know, again, I would actually go back to the fact that – What we are seeking to do, and what I'm seeking to do in an online context, is to make a better and a consistent connection between what people do see on the ground and what they see online. It is about that repetition. It is about the multi-channel means of engagement. And so my job and our role is to make sure that I have a – and you'll forgive me for using the term – but that I have sort of a 360-degree view of what the organization is doing, so that I can advise and collaborate with my colleagues in other departments so that you can maximize the value of the work that they are doing. that answer, I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know if you had any awesome sort of epiphanies about making voter registration fun and cool. That I feel like every cycle we're trying to make that process seem more manageable, especially for, you know, single women. These demographics tend to be the most mobile on their address changes. And so if there was anything you had to add there, I feel like I'm having conversations with lots of folks how we do that this year.
There's if you don't mind my jumping in, there's a new company called TurboVote.
Oh, yeah, no, TurboVote.
So, you know them.
Definitely on the radar, but there are a few cool things happening. You're right.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and just so people listening who may not have heard of TurboVote, it actually comes out of a graduate student at the Kennedy School at Harvard who had the inspiration to sort of see that, you know, students in particular are a constituency that move off and fail to re-register when they get to college, you know, often forget to get their absentee ballot application in, and that if you could make it as easy as requesting a video on Netflix, remember back when they used to mail them to you, that would be, you know, that could significantly reduce some of the obstacles to students, college students being registered and voting. And so I wonder if there's something there that could also work for in particular young women, who are in the Planned Parenthood constituency. I'm curious actually to ask Heather, thank you for that question, Megan, if the new membership coming in, in particular is a much younger demographic, you know, to what degree that understanding, it isn't just the leadership change at the top.
Yeah.
I've certainly noticed in some of the, some of the YouTube videos that Planned Parenthood has been making and trying to spread a real youthful style. That must be deliberate, a sense that's the group that you really need to be connecting with.
Without question, a core demographic for us of supporters is, I'd say, you know, if you want to broaden it, and it depends on who, you know, what, how people are engaging with us, but I would say writ large, our core demographic is 18 to 45 year old women, and in the younger level, this really goes back to what I was saying a couple minutes ago. But I mean, you know, the kids these days, which I am not one of, I'm firmly in the cynical Gen Xer role. But the younger generation has not just a facility with the internet, but they're content creators in ways that consistently amaze me. And so you're right. We are trying to it is a line that you're walking a little bit, because we are a professional nonprofit. We're not some person off the street, right? And so we have a brand, and we have a point of view, and we have an expertise that we're trying to communicate in everything that we do. At the same time, we are trying to reach a constituency who doesn't necessarily want to be engaged with in a super formal way, at least not on – well, actually, no, I think that's generally true. And so as with anything, these content projects are iterative, and so you make one, you sort of figure out what is interesting to people, and you make adjustments and you change it for the next time. But we've certainly tried to – do that with some of the women are watching stuff, and it's varied between sort of younger, I would say younger, flashier, and then the more, I guess, less polished, more organic kind of feel.
I'm going to use the word sexier, actually.
Ooh,
I think they're,
I love
they're,
it.
What I've noticed is that they try to be sex positive, which I think is interesting also in that, you know, that could, you know, a more conservative organization might say, we should be careful. We don't want that, you know. But it seemed to be embraced, you know, that whatever your research is telling you about what connects with young people, that you can't be, Oh God,
you
Prissy,
can't be
you got this.
That's the thing is, I don't think that for people under 25, you can be a reproductive health organization and not mention the sex. You
yeah.
know, like it's just impossible. And I think that also works again to the advantage. And when we're talking about the dynamics of young folks activism, I also am not a young person anymore. And I know this actually because of
you are to me, Deanna.
an employee of Personal Democracy Media. But that's
yeah.
a separate story. It's a funny uh-huh. story. But anyway, the demographics of young folks tend to not identify with the labels that, you know, Gen Xers and older identify with as liberal, progressive, feminist. You know, they have the same value sets, but they don't necessarily want to identify as such and be stuck with this particular identity label, and especially when it comes to sexuality. I mean, mm-hmm. and who they're sleeping with and not sleeping with and what they're doing with their bodies, they want to have absolute and complete freedom, as they mm. should. And recognizing that and running with it is a really smart move on Planned Parenthood's part.
Yeah, and I think it's where, and that's a good place to end up. It is, to me, really one of the points I keep coming back to as I watch how social media is spreading and being used, that, you know, we underappreciate sometimes. It isn't just that it's social in the sense that lots of people can use it or it's integrated into our social lives, but that there's something about it that has to actually reflect organically on how people actually live. And if you deny some aspect of, you know, what is part of people's authentic lives, it won't spread as well. That there's, you know, that social, in effect, we can sniff out the false notes.
Mm-hmm.
In
absolutely.
And that's, you know, so, you know, to the degree that an organization like Planned Parenthood has, you know, gotten in deep in this, in the pool, and not just, you know, tiptoeing in at the edge, it's also inevitably means that it has to embrace, you know, that whole complex reality and not just act as if, you know, some of these things don't exist and we're not going to talk about them. So that is part of the nature of social media, I guess.
Yeah,
well,
absolutely.
Thank you. This has been a great call. We've been talking with Heather Holdridge, the digital director of Planned Parenthood, and Deanna Zandt, media technologist. And tell us the name of your book, Deanna.
Share This! Exclamation
Share
point.
This!
How You Will Change the World with Social Networking.
That's right.
Good stuff.
It's a good book, well worth getting. You've been listening to Personal Democracy Media's teleconference, Personal Democracy Plus, with Heather Holdridge and Deanna Zandt. Thanks, everybody. And
Thank you.
We'll see you all online.
Thanks, Mika.